Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSilicast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, February 17th, 2008, and this is show number 136. Hey, was it fun having a surprise bonus show in the feed this week? That was exciting. Anyway, I had so much fun with Paige, I couldn't resist coming out with it as a standalone show. I got another question for you. Did you guys remember to tune into the Mac Roundtable last week? We had such a good time. We've been getting great feedback on the show. My favorite part of the show, though, is the outtakes at the end. It was hilarious. At least we thought we were funny. Anyway, be sure to check that out over at MacRoundtable.com. Well, Steve and I had a fun weekend this weekend. We got a new garage door installed, and we decided it was time to clean out the garage. You just have no idea what kind of junk you keep. I mean, and we're not big junk keepers. I mean, we keep two cars in the garage. Because, you know, I mean, the whole waxing thing, I'm not going to leave my cars outside if I can help it. But seriously, we had ski poles. We don't ski. We haven't skied since we were in our 20s. You know, once in a while, but we've never used those ski poles since we had the ski racks that we had in the 1970s. We had the lawnmower we had in 1983 when we got Roy, our long-term gardener and friend to this day. So we started pulling all this junk out. We found these three bags of concrete, which was handy since one of them exploded. We ended up having to put on hazmat suits to sweep that up because we were just coughing and wheezing and getting into my contact lenses. Oh, it was a mess. But anyway, we've got a lot of junk to throw away now. We even got some people to take some giveaway stuff, but our garage is clean. I can walk easily down either side of my car. It's nice. Oh, I've been wanting to do that for a long time, and I'm glad it's over with. Better take some Advil, though, I'm telling you. All right, into the show. Well, I've been racking my brains trying to remember who it was who wrote to me recently asking me what happened to the homework assignments. I'm guessing it was winter break. Yeah, that's it. It was winter break. That's why you didn't have a homework assignment for a while. All right. Here's your next homework assignment. How about this? We need to hear from someone from every continent. Now, I'm pretty sure we have Europe covered with Bart from Ireland, Hans from Austria, and Ben from the UK. Wait, Austria is in Europe, right? I am not good at this. Let's see. The US and Canada are pretty well covered. So North America, we're all set there. I haven't heard from Paul in Peru in ages, so I'm going to declare South America as open territory. We need some South Americans to write or call in, too. All right, that's three continents. Now, I'm not as far smart as a fifth grader, but my son assures me that there are seven continents. Oh, yeah, right. We have Australia with Rose and Jane, so that's four taken care of. That leaves Asia, Africa, and Antarctica. I can see we have listeners in Africa and Asia. I can see the downloads from those continents, but I'm not showing any hits yet from Antarctica. Well, for those of you in Africa and Asia who are already listening, I need you to check in. Send me an email, or better yet, a voice recording so we know you're out there. And if Paul from Peru is still there or someone else from South America, I need to hear from you too. But how do we get some folks from Antarctica to start listening? There's what, like five people there? But I bet they have a Mac user group. Well, anyway, you have your assignment. Now get to work, kids. Well, if you haven't had enough talk of Twitter clients, Duncan wrote in with a site that lists a gazillion Twitter clients. It's at twitter.pbwiki.com. They have them sorted by operating system, and they include a short description of each application. You can go crazy in there, but I am done looking at Twitter clients. Well, James from the UK wrote in. No, it's not crazy James. It's a normal James, or at least I assume he's normal. Anyway, here's what he said. I just wanted to write and let you know how much I enjoy your show, and that I also have what could be a useful link. It's called KeyXL from KeyXL.com. That's KeyXL.com. I thought it might be useful for everyone, but especially your mom, who I seem to remember you mentioned is blind. I too am blind, and although I've not had a chance to check this out yet, it's supposed to be a huge database of keystrokes for a massive number of applications on all platforms. It may also be useful for other listeners, as keystrokes can make you more productive as you don't need to take your hands off the keyboard. Well, James, this couldn't have come at a better time. I've recently been forced to use a Vista machine at work, so I'm literally a 50-year-old Windows neophyte, so I really need to learn some shortcut keys. The one thing that's been driving me nuts is how in the heck you actually quit a program. People say Alt-F4, but that doesn't work on chat clients. If you do that, they're still down in that taskbar thingy there. I needed to do a screencast at work, so I Alt-F4'd all my applications so I wouldn't get any pop-ups on screen. But sure enough, right in the middle of my recording, here comes Pigeon jumping up on screen. My friend Tony said, Windows is really not that bad. It's just death by a thousand paper cuts that gets to you. I'm sure feeling that. Anyway, KeyXL is very well organized and has a ton of links sorted by application or operating system. They even give a link over to Wikipedia where they have a page with even more shortcuts. I appreciate the tip, James. The one person it won't help is my mother because she's on DOS. She's not even on Windows 3.1. She's on DOS. She's on a 386, and that's only because we upgraded her a couple of years ago from a 286. She uses an application called Lion Large Type, which was written in the 80s, I think, and it sits on top of WordPerfect in DOS. She knows how to use it. It's basically a typewriter is all she has, and we've never been able to move her over to a modern machine. We pretty much have her doing her what she can, and she's tried taking some classes at over at Braille, but she's 87 and blind and doesn't let a thing slow her down, so I wouldn't put it past her to get into this eventually. By the way, I do plan to interview her for the show sometime. I think you guys will get a kick out of her. To have someone who's 87 years old and blind, and she's totally into technology from a mental standpoint. She doesn't get to play with it much, but she's really interested in it. Makes her a lot of fun to talk to. Well, last week I talked about Texter, which is a great little piece of open source software for Windows that does text substitution, you know, like Text Expander does on the Mac. I was all excited about it until it stopped working. Well, I got an email from Mike telling me that the same thing happened to him. His texter worked great for a while and then stopped. I haven't yet figured out a way to communicate with the developers, but I'm still trying. I think I should be able to track them down. Mike heard about my great Buffalo experience, and he just chose a Buffalo external drive. And it was on sale. Doesn't get much better than that. Oh, and Mike also said that his cousin Christine lives within Honda Bob's range, and she drives a Honda Odyssey. But get this, she hasn't called Honda Bob yet. Well, to be fair, she's only needed oil changes so far because her car's pretty young, but maybe she'll come around. Christine, you're out there? Give Honda Bob a call. Oh, perhaps some of you haven't even heard about Honda Bob yet, so I might be getting ahead of myself. He's my mechanic, and while it might seem a bit odd to advertise for your mechanic on a tech show, you need to know that he's a hardcore geek himself. He does his own website over at hdabob.com, and he loves cool software tools. Another thing he told me about just this week, he replaced the battery in his son's dead iPod mini for only $17. His son was really happy about that. The best part about Honda Bob is that he actually drives to your house or your place of business and works on your car at your convenience. No driving to some creepy shop and sitting with the great unwashed reading old magazines all day or trying to find a ride back and forth to the dealer. He comes to you. He covers the LA and Orange County areas. That's where you work, Christine, and he does a marvelous job. If you'd like to contact him, try his phone at 562-531-2321 or shoot him an email over at hdabob@aol.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. Well, Gerard from the Netherlands wrote in with an intriguing request. Here's what he said. Hello, Allison. First of all, you have a great show. Thank you for that. Is it possible for you to make a show about podcasting itself? How to produce, upload, hosting, bandwidth, what does it cost, GarageBand, etc., etc.? Geeks are always interested in how other geeks do things. Maybe here's an idea of how to split it up. You could have a section on concept and writing, a section on recording, a section on post-production, filtering, etc., and a section on upload, RSS, bandwidth, and hosting. I hope you decide to podcast about it. Few podcasters do. Victor, Adam, etc. rarely speak about it. Actually, rather strange, because the tech stuff behind it is what all geeks like to play with. I'm asking because I'm a PR consultant of a police force here in the Netherlands, and besides the fact that we make web TV at pit.tv, I'm looking for a way of tying podcasting in with our communications with our citizens. You, Tim, Adam, Victor, Steve, etc. have fans in the Netherlands. It's a small country with a big Mac community. Gerard. Well, Gerard, I love your letter, and I think that's a really good idea. I think I'll go ahead and work on this for you, and anyone else who's interested. The one reason I hesitate a little bit, though, is I think I do things the hard way. I learned how to do this when you had to use a hammer and chisel, practically, and I think there's easier ways to accomplish the same result. But let me work on it anyway. I think I could provide some interesting tips. Maybe I'll do like a segment a week so it doesn't bore those of you not interested in doing the show. In any case, Gerard, I'm glad to know there's lots of Macs in Netherlands. And if you want to just contact me directly again, and when you get stuck on certain bits, I'd be glad to help you. So many people helped me put this together over the years that, I mean, I've just got to give back because everybody helped me do it. So how could I say no to anybody else? Well, I finally got time to start testing out DiskLabel from smileonmymac.com. You may remember my interview with Gene McDonald about this software. Finally, it was time to give it a shot myself. As always, what's the problem to be solved? Well, I've made probably 100 disk labels using Photoshop Elements, and I dread doing it. My husband Steve makes DVDs of our home movies, including transcoding all of our old VHS tapes. He keeps churning these things out, and I have to make clever labels with photos of our family and all the scene selections on the back. DiskLabel is intended to make this process easy, so I thought maybe if it was fun, I wouldn't dread it so much. DiskLabel has a very unusual interface that is pleasing to the eye. You have a choice of Edit, Media, or Store as tabs across the bottom. When you're in the Edit mode, you have four columns of information. The name of your projects are on the left column, so they're all stored together, which is really nice. I actually have just folders and folders and folders of all these labels I've made. And the various label options are in the second column. So like the CD DVD label itself, the jewel case cover, the jewel case insert, the jewel case booklet, all those are in the second column. Then the third column is a huge column that, and that's where you actually work on the label you're using on. So for example, like a gigantic disc label in the middle, big circle to work in. Finally, there's the fourth column, and that's where you can see various templates for the kind for the label element you're working on. In the example of a disc label itself, on the right-hand side, there'd be all kinds of options about how to display the text and see the photos and that sort of thing. Well, DiskLabel integrates extremely well with iPhoto and iTunes so that you can pick pictures of your own and import tracks from playlists. Well, since I'm not making music CDs, the iTunes integration won't be the focus of my review, but if you are making iTunes, playlists from CDs, that would be very handy. One of my happiest moments in using DiskLabel was when I discovered that while it was integrated with iPhoto, it didn't make me use iPhoto. I've been keeping my digital photos organized all on my own. Again, I always like the hammer and chisel method, it seems. I've been doing it long before the existence of iPhoto, so I never converted over. One thing I wish that DiskLabel did there was actually show me the name of the photo that I'm clicking on. I think I must be the only person in the whole universe who actually still names their photos. But in this case, the photos I'm making all have a number next to them that tell me which ones are going to go to which disk. So it would have been really handy to know the names of the photos that I'm going to work with. See, Steve's latest project is making DVDs of his sister's home movies on VHS because it wasn't enough work to do all of ours. Anyway, since I don't have high-res photos of their lives, we decided to take screenshots from within iMovie. It's not going to be the highest quality, of course, but it'll trigger their memory of which DVD is which. And we figured if we flung a bunch of them around on the disc so they were small, they wouldn't look so bad, and that would be a pretty cool surface. I jumped into DiskLabel with both feet, and I got stuck almost immediately. I easily found the menu pick that lets you create a montage of photo on your discs, which I thought that sounded ideal. There's a bunch of options about how to display them. You can do it in a grid, film, surround, randomize, and pie. Sounds great. But none of them look too good with my photos. No worries, once it places the photo on the discs, I figured I could just move them around and slide them so that they all looked right. Nope, they're stuck there. They're all one image once you do that. Shoot, that would have been fun. Oh well, no worries, I'll just plop the pictures in and resize at will. Well, this is kind of scary because I have little artistic skill and I was kind of hoping DiskLabel would do that for me, but I was willing to go for it. The first picture I tried to resize by holding down the shift key and dragging a corner. It didn't stay in proportion. It got all, you know, too short or too tall or whatever. Oh, no. Well, I searched everywhere for the answer, and I finally resorted to writing to Jean to find the solution. Here's what she wrote. Based on our years of customer support, we've put a lot of what I call training wheels into DiskLabel. One of them is, by default, resizing is proportional unless you hold down the shift key. It's the opposite of what Photoshop users expect. If you go into preferences, you can uncheck this default, as well as a couple other defaults that are counterintuitive to the more experienced graphic user. See attached for my preference pane, and she sent me a little picture. Well, that's an interesting perspective. I'm not sure I 100% agree with the logic, though, since holding the shift key down for a proportional resize isn't just in Photoshop. It's how you make a circle instead of an oval or a square instead of a rectangle in every drawing program on the Mac and even on a PC. Heck, it's even the way you proportionally resize an image in Microsoft Word and Microsoft PowerPoint. Oh well, once I had the toggle set right, all was good. Except I still had no artistic talent. Well, back to work. I wanted to know more about all of the editing options, and if you've been listening to the show for any length of time, you know I wasn't going to read the manual, right? Instead, I headed over to smileonmymac.com, and I went hunting for some video instruction. Imagine my delight when I discovered video screencasts by my good friend Don McAllister of screencastsonline.com. He does a terrific job. If you haven't checked out his screencast, you really do want to head over there sometime. One of my favorite features of DiskLabel was that I could import an image, resize, and then double-click on it, and it brings up the image in this lovely crop tool. It works like a champ. It's really quick, it's easy and intuitive. It's exactly what I was looking for. I don't think I completely follow how the text label thingies work so much. Again, this is a design decision that most people would like to click through a bunch of presets until they see something they like. I've been doing this so long by hand that I'm inclined to want to hard code it myself. So again, I think I'm kind of not the right customer for DiskLabel in that part, because I'm kind of a control freak, but I tried to mellow out here and let it do it. Well, I really hate to do this, but I have to admit that throughout my use of DiskLabel, I found myself struggling quite a bit. For example, I got my photos sprinkled around on the disk, I added a black background, which took me a long time to figure out how to do, and then I laid some text on a white rectangle. Okay, good to go. Then I started to work on the CD cover, and I thought I'd go select that text, or even the whole text box, and copy it over to the cover too. No dice. I could not grab that text box. I couldn't edit the text. I couldn't select the text. All I could do was slide it around. If I double-clicked it, it seemed to go into the crop tool. That got me thinking maybe my layer had gotten behind some other layer. So I right-clicked and sent whatever it was I was selecting to the back, and then I was allowed to select the text. Thought that was kind of strange because it was sort of like the last thing I did. DiskLabel uses layers, but they don't, that I could find anyway, and of course I didn't read the manual, they don't give you a place where you can see the layers so you can tell which one you're clicking on or move them up and down that way. And I know that's a Photoshop-y kind of thing to ask for, but if you're going to use layers, it'd be nice to be able to see them, to see where they are. All right, so now I was working on the back cover, and I want to do that montage thing now. Since it's easier on a square than on a circle, I figured it would import nicely. In order to toggle on the montage, you have to select the pictures first. But as soon as I clicked one picture, it plopped it onto the cover. I struggled back and forth trying to trick it into letting me select all of the photos I wanted before it did the plopping. Well, I finally got it to work, but I'm not exactly sure how I caused it to let me do that, because I struggled with it for quite a while, and then it did work. And then I tried to print. I had my CD label up in front, and I hit Command-P to print. This brought up a window that looked like a CD label template, but it wasn't the one I wanted to print on. Down at the bottom, it had a pull-down for Avery 8696. So I tried pulling it down to see if it had some options for the Fellows labels that I own. No Fellows in the list. Well, then next to the CD in the second column, there was an arrow. I right-clicked on it, and it offered me to find compatible media. Cool beans! In here, they had all of the manufacturers, so I selected Fellows Neato. But guess what? No Fellows labels are available to me. I searched all over the Fellows box, and nowhere on it could I find the compatible Avery label, which is kind of lame on the part of Fellows. That's not DiskLabel's fault. But since I couldn't get any Fellows labels, I can't use the labels I own. Well, I think if you were a newbie at this whole disk labeling thing, or you were willing to go with predefined formats, of the many, many formats I do offer, and you were especially interested in burning CDs for music, DiskLabel would be a great solution. For my very specific need to add photos and scene names to a DVD label, and since I'm kind of a control freak, it wasn't for me. I went back to my hammer and chisel method with Photoshop Elements. You know, I really, really wanted to like this product, but it seemed to fight me every step of the way. So I felt awful because Gene and the other folks I chatted with at Smile on My Mac are so nice. Give me a chance to do some soul searching, though. I really wondered, what do? Do I pretend to love a product because the people are nice? Well, that wouldn't be fair to you. I've built my reputation on the fact that I tell the truth. I say it like it is. I can't ever get away from that, no wonder, even if it makes me sad. So, I bit the bullet and I wrote a note to Jean telling her that I wasn't going to be raving about Disc Label. And what she wrote back was wonderful. In her email, she showed the caliber of her character and the company she works for. Here's what she wrote back. Oh dear, I'm really sorry Disc Label has caused you so much frustration. A couple of questions. Did you ever contact support directly? And is there another labeling program that you find more intuitive? We do have thousands of happy users, and we get great testimonials and awards. But we also know that we can't rest on our laurels. We are actively working on making Disc Label as intuitive as possible. To that end, I would be really interested in knowing more about where the program fails for you. Would you consider going through some of the steps with me via iChat screen sharing? I know that's asking a lot from a busy person. I really want us to learn from your experience and where we are failing an experienced Mac user like you. Isn't that great? Instead of being offended or mad, she wants to know how they can improve the product for me. I thought a lot of their company before this, but now they're rock solid in my mind. Remember, Smile on My Mac are the folks that make the product I would never live without, Text Expander. So go check it out for yourself. Well, I'm really getting frustrated about backups. You know, I converted over to Leopard, which meant I lost Super Duper, and everybody was raving about Time Machine. Time Machine will solve all your problems. So I hooked up my Seagate, I think it's a 300 gig drive, and I hooked it up. It's a FireWire drive, and I hooked it up to my Mac, and I tried to run Time Machine. Well, it seemed to do a few backups, but I had an odd problem. I couldn't see my home folder in the disk mode. But it turned out if I looked at it in Time Machine, my home folder was there. Well, that was kind of odd. But I've also had trouble with this disk over the years. I don't know what's wrong with it. It's got kind of a flaky cable connection. Sometimes it goes halfway through and then it stops. And I don't know. It's been flaky. Maybe the FireWire interface is flaky, or maybe there's something wrong with the case. So backups would just hang up after a while. Okay, I know that disk has problems. It's my big disk, but let me go ahead and go on to another one. So I pulled out a 160 gig MacStore portable USB drive. Time Machine worked perfectly, until it didn't work at all. I would go to do the Time Machine backup, and it would say, no, I'm full. And I would check, and it had a lot of room, like 60 gig, had a ton of room. So I told it to back up less stuff. I took more and more things out, and I told it to do less. And it had like 60 gig free, like I said, but it still said it was full. Wouldn't do a backup. I thought Time Machine was smart enough to throw the old stuff away anyway, so even if it was full, why would that be bad? Okay, fine. So finally, Super Duper for Leopard came out last week. Ah, oh, the joy. Back to Super Duper. This is going to be great. So I bought another drive. I bought an iOmega 500 gig USB drive. I got like this stack of drives here now. It's crazy. So I launched Super Duper, and I got a nice backup, ran like a champ. But guess what? Just like Time Machine on the Seagate, I can't see my home folder. It's really weird. If I go under Users, it only shows Shared, and it doesn't show the other users, like Allison, for example. However, just like in Time Machine, those files are actually there. I went into it using the terminal, and I can see the folder. I can see Allison. I did a search in the Finder, and I could see the files that are inside Allison. It would show me the path, and it would show me Allison was there. But in the regular Finder window, it won't show it to me there. I also did a mount volume thing. What was it? I forget. Bart told me how to do it. Command, Shift, Option, G, and swing a dead cat over your head, something. Anyway, I was able to put in the volume name, and then Allison would show up, but it's kind of this, you know, grayish blue icon instead of being a regular blue icon, so I still can't see inside of it. I do not understand. Is it me? Is it just me? Does somebody not want me to back up? Well, someday I hope I'll be able to figure out what's wrong with this, but in the meantime, at least the backup is there. Should be nice if I could see it, though. Well, it's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from bartbouchatz.ie. How are you doing this late evening, Bart?
I'm doing very well. I just had, actually, it's been good weather all week, so I get out today, lots of photography and stuff. You know, it's one of those strange weeks where it's really good weather all week while you're stuck in work, and you think come Friday it's going to fail, but it didn't.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. I really appreciate you accommodating my son's track meet schedule again. I was gone for like 5 hours today watching track, so appreciate waiting for me.
So out of the 5 hours, how many seconds was Kyle actually running?
Well, let's see. I think there were two, maybe 40. Wait, he did an 800, so that's like, I don't know, 80 or 90 seconds, and then one 400 and a 4x4, so that's another, 40, 50 seconds. It's 2 minutes.
Not a great rate of return.
No, it turns out the people are really, really fun. All the parents are a riot, so we entertained ourselves for the whole 5 hours, so that was pretty good. But anyway, let's kick into gear here. Well, listener Martin Hauser has been a lot of fun to talk to over the last year or so. He's helped me out with my video conversion stuff I was doing, all the FFmpeg stuff, and he was nice enough to write up an in-depth explanation about the tools that are now available to install Linux applications on the Mac. Now, he put a great explanation on his blog, and I don't want to snake that from him. I put a link in the show notes so you can read the detail of how he explains all the different ways that you can add the Linux applications on your Mac. The only problem is I asked Bart to help me out with this conversation because I'm not really quite up to this topic. I'm not near as smart as Martin thinks I am. So anyway, Martin did give me some sense of why I'd want to start on this adventure, but I was hoping maybe Bart could give me some more ideas of why I would want to do this and what is Martin actually talking about.
Well, it's quite a good blog post. Is very good, although I did get distracted before I ever managed to read it because it's very good on the side of his blog post. So after I got over looking at all the pictures, I finally got around to reading what he had to write.
Oh shoot, it got broken up a little bit there, Bart. I think what you said was his Flickr photos were really good, right?
Yeah, very distracting in a good way.
Yeah, we lost about 5 or 10 minutes before we even got started because we were going over and looking at these awesome pictures he's got. So it's worth going to his blog, if only for that.
Exactly. But no, Martin describes very well sort of four different techniques for getting Linux-style programmer to install on your Mac. He starts off with sort of the bad way, the old-fashioned, horrible way, compiling the stuff from source, and it's icky and messy, and you really don't. But he explains it in gory detail so that if you were to want to, you could, but you don't. Then he goes on to talk probably what in theory should be the nicest way is Fink, which in theory has a nice GUI and stuff. It's just let me down a few times in the real world. So I sort of go through phases of loving Fink and then hating Fink and then loving Fink and then hating Fink. And at the moment I think I'm going to hate Fink because it let me down recently. Then he goes on to talk about one that's never let me down, which maybe because I've only been using it the last 6 months or so. But that's something called Mac ports, which we should talk about in a minute. And then the last technique he talks about is something I'd never even heard of, which is basically getting a mini Gentoo install into your Mac OS and then installing stuff in there. I'm not really sure how that works. Talk about that very much. But anyway.
Okay, so
it's interesting.
What does Mac ports do for you? What's the trick of that?
Mac ports gives you sort of OS X is based off of FreeBSD, and on FreeBSD they have a really good package management system called ports. So it's not entirely surprising that someone decided to port ports to the Mac. So it looks after. Do you remember way back we did a whole big discussion on Linux package management?
Yeah, when I was in dependency heck.
Yeah, that's the one. And I explained how, you know, if you have a good package manager, none of that happens. Well, ports on FreeBSD is a package manager, and Mac ports is a package manager for the Mac, obviously. So it lets you get at all the Linux stuff in a really simple way. So basically, it comes down to typing sudo port install name of package, enter. And it will go off and it will find all the dependencies, all the magic stuff for you. It'll compile it all for you. You just sit there and watch the progress. It'll be done and it'll just work.
So would that be like, let's say I knew that I wanted to install Text Expander. I could just use, and let's say Text Expander was on Linux. I could, in this Mac ports thing, I could say sudo install and then throw in the name of the software and then it would just go find everything it needed to find to do it and I wouldn't have to know where it was?
Precisely. I recently installed the GIMP that way. Literally sudo port space install space GIMP dash app. Off it went and got absolutely everything it needed and installed the GIMP.
Oh, that's pretty cool. By the way, for anybody who doesn't already know, the GIMP is a fantastic open source photo editing application. It's very Photoshop-esque, like with a make it a little harder than you think it should be kind of Linux layer on top of it is the way I would describe it. It's almost fantastic.
it's very powerful, but the GUI could do a bit of polish, really. Especially on the Mac, where there's the extra confusion that uses X11 rather than the native Mac window manager. So whenever you end up going back to X11, things always get inky. And that's one downside to all of these Linux apps that you're going to install with any of these techniques of Martin's, is they're all going to be X11 if they have a GUI at all.
Oh, they are. But I thought you could run things like, there is a GIMP shop is a thing that goes with GIMP that allows you to run it not in X11, I thought. Or am I getting mixed up with something to do with OpenOffice?
You're getting slightly mixed up there. There is a project called AquaGIMP. Aqua, I can't remember which one it goes. But the theory there is they're trying to port the GIMP over to use Aqua instead of X11.
Oh.
But I haven't managed to get that to work yet. GIMP, Mac, or GIMP, the other one.
GIMP Shop.
Called. Yeah, what they're trying to do there is they're trying to make GIMP's menus the same as Photoshop's menus, so that if you know Photoshop, you can just switch straight to GIMP Shop.
Oh, I remember what it was. In fact, it might even have been Martin I should give it credit to. I'm not sure, but I remember I used to think that that X11 was horrible and awful and slow, but it was just because I was using it with OpenOffice, and it was OpenOffice itself that was a big hog and annoying. That X11 isn't actually awful. It's, you know, a layer you'd rather not go through, but it's not horrible.
It's not horrible, but it has some nasty side effects, because everything you run within X11, as far as OS X is concerned, X11 is an app. So if you're running one X11 program, it's fine, because you just Apple tab across to X11, and there's all your GIMP windows. But if you're running two X11 apps at the same time, as far as OS X is concerned, it's one app, it's X11. So when you're Apple tabbing, you get all the windows from all your X11 apps together. And if you're running a few, it gets messy very quickly.
Ah, I see. Well, so now let's start with a problem to be solved, or let's in the middle bring up a problem to be solved. Why would I want to install a Linux application on the Mac?
Okay, sometimes not everything exists on the Mac. I mean, ideally speaking, you'd prefer to get a native Mac implementation of something, but that's not always an option. So let me see, for years I always installed KStars from Linux distribution. KStars is this cool free astronomy program that comes free with KDE on Linux, and it's fairly straightforward stuff. It renders the sky as it looks anywhere, anytime, and you can pick it up and spin around and zoom in and zoom out. It's just cool. And, you know, there was no OS X version. There was, in fact, very little free astronomy software for OS X at the time. So I used to just download and install that Linux program on the Mac and use it that way, and it worked really well for you.
Okay. So I guess that's the part I didn't think about, was there are applications that run on Linux that don't exist on the Mac. Astronomy program, that sounds like fun. I also asked Martin about this, and he gave me a list of applications, but not too many that I would say are real mainstream. He's a software programmer, so there's a lot of tools he talked about, like Git and Subversion and let's see, GNU Screen, a program that allows one to have multiple terminals per tab window, which is, and he gives a longer explanation than that, but it's a lot of command line stuff. So it looks like there's a lot of tools that are available on for programmers that maybe would be handy to have over. The only one that sounded mainstream was Image Magic, and Image Magic is also available on the Mac. So I'm having a little trouble figuring out why a normal person might need to do this.
The more time you spend in the terminal, the more likely you are to want to do this. There are some reasons normal people might want to do it, but the more nerdy you are, the more likely you're going to like this. Let me think. Just thinking back to what I actually use it for, the GIMP is a good one. There's GNU Cache, it's a fantastic little free bookkeeping program I use a lot, and now I just let my accountant do my bookkeeping. I've just gotten lazy. But no, the nice thing about doing it through this is that the stuff it's easy to update because it's package management. So if there's a new version of the GIMP comes out, you just say port upgrade GIMP-app or whatever, and you get the latest version that way. So you don't have, you know, it's nice for keeping everything up to date as well. But really, it's often for the more and stuff that I would use it. The main thing I'm using it for now this minute is to get the PostgreSQL database server on my Mac, because I do a lot of development on my Mac. And Image Magic, because I do a lot of development on my Mac. And the GIMP, because it was giving me trouble on Leopard, and when I did it this way, it gave me no trouble, and no trouble's good.
Interesting. So, by the way, I didn't mean to call you and Martin abnormal. I didn't mean any offense there.
Oh, no offense taken, but it's fair to say that our use sort of is common use.
Right. Well, I think that has cleared it up to some extent. I think I understand a little bit better. I do still wonder whether I would do it, but I might give it a try on Image Magic because I had not installed that yet. I just actually heard about it on Leo Laporte's show. I forget which one of his 48 shows it was on, but they were talking about it, and I thought, wow, I should go download that. But maybe I'll try doing it with Mac ports and see if I can figure out how it works.
Magic libraries on their own, I'm not really sure what you're going to do with them, to be honest, because they're command line tools. I have a bunch of scripts I use to resize all my images, stick in the little Bart Bouchot's that IE thing at the bottom, and the little Creative Commons logo before I publish this on my blog. But I wrote a little script, so that's a little Perl script that gets a list of all the files in a directory, fires the whole lot off at Image Magic. Image Magic does its magic and spits back out the and I upload my server. But you'd need to get pretty comfortable on the command line for Image Magic to be any good to you.
No, I thought Image Magic was, as it's described on their website, if you read up about it, it describes it as a program that would help you convert images. But I didn't realize it was a command line program.
It's a collection of command line programs, in fact. They can do insanely powerful things. At their simplest level, one of the commands is convert. So you say convert myfile.jpg space myfile.png, and it'll magically know that PNG means portable network graphic, JPEG means JPEG. It'll do the conversion and spit out the file, no bother. But you can pass it in arguments to say, I'd like it resized to a maximum dimension of 800. While you're at it, I'd like to throw in the following text at the following coordinates, and stick in this image at these coordinates as well. I mean, you can really keep going with it. You can say, throw a border around this, throw a shadow around that. But it's all on the command line.
So maybe I'll go back to that double-clicking packages thing on as installers. I'm not sure I'm up to this.
Well, a good way to start, because there's a GUI for Fink called Fink Commander, and that literally lets you browse through all the packages, right-click, install, and away it goes.
Now, you can do that in Fink, right?
Yeah, that's Fink Commander.
Is
the GUI. Fink Commander is a GUI for Fink.
I think that's the way
you can do Fink from the command line too.
I think I installed OpenOffice that way the first time I did it, but now I'm using NeoOffice, so I'm not in. I don't think I'm in X11 at all anymore. There, am I?
No, you're not. Not if you're using NeoOffice. I'm only really in X11 these days for GIMP, I think.
Oh, okay, I see. Well, is there anything else interesting we can say on this topic?
Basically, if you're interested in getting into sort of the more Unix-y underpinnings of OS X, then we'll do it either with Fink, if you know, as a good starting place. Mac ports is probably the best of them. If you really want to go insanely mad, you can start installing the stuff from source yourself. It's a really good way to understand what's going on under the hood, but it's not really pleasant.
So I'll say this, go to that link, but in any case, what we do want you to do is go over and check out Martin's blog, and if the command line stuff is a little too rugged for you, take a look at his photos, because they're really breathtaking.
Yeah, they're fantastically artistic. They're just cool pictures. You know, they really distract you, and the little square thumbnails from his Flickr feed, and as you start clicking through, you just get lost in the good way.
All right, Bart. Well, I thank you for helping me understand this stuff. And if there's nothing else, I think we're going to call it a day.
I think we'll call it a day. So until next time, happy computing.
Well, I think it's time to call it a day on the entire show. So I'm going to leave you with a reminder of your homework assignment. You need to find someone from Africa, Asia, and Antarctica. Oh, and South America needs to check in. Give me a holler if so we know you're out there. Extra credit for Antarctica, by the way. Keep up all the great emails. I love hearing from you. Email me at allison@podfeet.com. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.